Today sees the return of our stablemate podcast, Security Bites. Hosted by Jim Tiller, our group CISO, he talks to security experts from across the industry, bringing you the latest in cyber.
They will lay in wait in your environment for months, surveilling the environment, researching your business to determine the worst day on the planet. And the worst thing that they can do to you to maximize the extortion.
Welcome to Security Bites, a show where we're joined by an industry-leading cybersecurity expert to discuss today's pressing business and technical challenges of security. Join me, your host, Jim Tiller, brought to you by and powered by Nash Square. Let's get started. I am really happy to introduce to you an old friend and former colleague for today's show. And I got to tell you, we're going to be talking about some really exciting stuff for anybody who is trying to fight the ransomware battle. I am not one to say much about, I don't think silver bullets exist, but I'm telling you, this one's getting pretty close to it when it comes to ransomware. My guest today is the director, or was the director for sales for Cisco throughout the 90s. So he's a networking guru when it comes to the internet. Then became the CEO of Kiko, and then started to completely focus on cybersecurity more than two decades ago as the general manager at Aruba. He became the chief marketing officer for Occuvant, and then Optiv in 2010. And that's where we had the opportunity to work together. But now he is the chief marketing officer for Nubiva. He's a great guy, an absolute blast to talk to. I give you Steve Perkins. How you doing, Steve?
I am doing great, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. We just chit-chatted a second ago before I hit the record button. We've had an opportunity to converse lately about this podcast. And for everybody listening, I'm really, really excited about this. Steve and I have a number of times to talk about what he's doing over at Nubiva, what the team is accomplishing. And I remember I remember when you first joined and you were excited as well. And I was like, wow, this seems really, really cool. And it's come so far. So listen, before we go down this amazing path, we're going to have to take some steps here to bring the audience along. Let's just give me a little bit about Nubiva. Is it a startup? Has it been around a while? Is it a cyber company? Or tell me about it a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So kind of an interesting story into itself. So actually, technically, it's Nubeva. That's all right. No biggie. It's a name I inherited from the two founders. I joined like day two, but the two founders chose it. And the CEO of the company is actually he's a son of a Chinese diplomat, grew up in Central America, so his native language is Spanish. And when he built the company, he called it Nubeva, which means cloud go in Spanish, Nubeva, right? And because when they started the company, they said, hey, we want to build a cool technology innovation company that kind of breaks the mold and isn't built around becoming the next big thing. It's let's just build some important technologies. So the company was founded a little over 5 years ago. We're past startup. We're a public company. Interesting part of that is that rather than funding ourselves through VCs, we funded the company ourselves. And then we did a penny stock IPO on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So we became public as a startup. And then since then, we've been finding our way and growing. And that in itself is a whole different story. But what it means is that as a company, we have a different set of drivers since day one. It's about building a profitable value-based business, not just, hey, let's blow money, let's get big and hope we finally go public, right? So every day our employees wake up, myself included, and we just say, how can we add value? How can we grow? How can we create value to our customers, ourselves, our shareholders? And it's a really interesting dynamic that alone creates. That's a little background, yeah.
Yeah, and I find that really interesting because we've all in some way, shape, or form throughout our decades in this industry been like, okay, let's buy it, bloat it, grow it, sell it, make it go public, make a lot of money. And that's worked a lot. But I think on the employment side, when you're like, okay, let's do it to do something interesting, do something for our customers, do something for the industry. I think that's a really interesting message, and I'm probably sure it had a pretty major impact on how things are created over there. Okay, so before we really get into the heart of the matter, I want to just take a moment and just make sure we get everybody on the same playing field and talk a little bit about encryption. So what we're going to talk about on the show today is how to beat ransomware. And Nubeva has a very interesting approach to this, very interesting product suite, and I definitely want us to talk about it. But I think for everybody, so we start on the same playing field, let's talk about encryption. So I'd like to hear, you know, I'd like to hear your version of how you explain encryption, because I think encryption is really at the key of this, maybe less so than traditional cybersecurity, right?
Yeah, well, does it make sense for us to real quick touch on, you know, what is ransomware?
Sure,
Is a whole part
there.
Of it, right? Because, yeah. Well, because the reality is there's lots of different types of threats in the world, right? Cyber threats. And one of them is where people ransom you. They hold something of value hostage of yours, and they charge you money. Now, I say it that way in an important way because there's lots of things that they've started ransoming. Traditionally, though, ransomware is malicious software that somehow gets into your site, into your operations, and one day it detonates and it encrypts data. Okay, it locks up the data so that you can't get access to it. And they actually basically hold the keys to unlock it ransom. And I say it that way because there is another kind of ransomware, which is they've started doing this where they'll exfiltrate data. They'll steal it, they'll hold it, and they'll say, I'm going to let this loose. I'm going to expose this information out to the internet if you don't pay me money. That's also, if you think about it, ransomware. So technically, though, the type of ransomware that we're focused on is the most prolific. It's called crypto-based ransomware, and it deals with the encryption of data to hold it hostage so that you pay them money to unlock it so that you can get your data back. Is that clear, or does that
absolutely right sense? On right spot yeah. on. I'm glad you brought yeah. that up. Sometimes I leap over some things like that, and it's worth, you know, understanding that now there's become so many layers to that ransom. So what now you'll see is, and I'm sure you'll talk about this, is varying degrees of decryption. So they'll say, I'll give you a key for all your doc files, you pay for that, then I'll give you a key for all your PowerPoint or Excel files. And then, of course, you have secondary, tertiary types of ransomware, what you said earlier about getting data exfiltration, then they encrypt it, and then they, you know, hold you hostage against the, you know, expose, if you will, of your data and all that kind of stuff. But with you, what Nubeva is really focused on is that cryptographic element, the crypto piece of it that creates this first, yeah. shall we say, first round of ransomware. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because they are getting tricky. They're actually double extortion ransomware is a common practice now where they'll exfiltrate data. And so you'll get a ransom note that says, hey, pay me to decrypt your data and pay me to not release your data. Mm-hmm. So they get you coming and going. Which, if you really think about it, those are two different, distinct business problems. It may be that your data is, you don't care if it's released. It really isn't that tangible of value. Maybe it is. Who knows? Some people believe that once they have your data, you know, if you think paying them, they're not going to release it on the dark web, you're kind of nuts. So the real problem is when your data is ransomed, your operations are down. And now time is ticking. Time is money, right? So imagine, you know, some critical function in your business is not operating. You can't take orders. You can't service customers. You start to hemorrhage cash. Or if you're a city, you can't service people, right? You can't do your prime function, which is public safety or you name it. That's what's insidious about this. So as you know, I mean, it's not simply, let's just get in there, some kids in a garage, and let's hack your computer and lock it up and see if we can get a couple bucks. They will lay in wait in your environment for months, surveilling the environment, researching your business to determine the worst day on the planet and the worst thing that they can do to you to maximize the extortion.
That's a really, really good point. They do get in. I mean, not to abuse, you know, surveys and market reports, but, you know, they say the average time of hackers in your environment is like over 200 days still to this day, right? Because they're doing a lot of intelligence. But also there's a theory as well, as they're so busy taking people down that sometimes you don't have time to get back to you to take advantage. But, and you're also bringing up an interesting point where sometimes the point where the ransom, the malware is detonated is, you know, long after they've done everything else they wanted to do. Now they just kind of lift up the curtain and make it happen. And I also just want to put a fine point on the fact that not only, I think a lot of people get in their, they understand like when their internet's down, they can't do anything, right? And then you say, you translate that to a business. Wow, you know, yeah, if we can't get our access to data, we can't do anything. But today, two things. One is we have huge digital transformation where even some basic companies now are fully reliant on digital. Maybe 5 years ago, 2 years ago, they weren't. So it's created a much broader, you know, target base for the bad guys. And also, I don't think people truly understand the impacts of ransomware until you get impacted. When you're on the receiving end, it's a debilitating feeling. Debilitating.
Because they are trying to extract maximum damage against you. It's not just, hey, let's just lock up whatever we can. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure out what is the key element or asset that they can cripple so that it does the most business damage. Let me give a couple examples, because you're right. I think there's an interesting survey that was done. I don't know if it was Sophos did a very large scale survey, like 5 or 10,000 CIOs around and CISOs about this, but it might have been them or somebody else. I apologize. I don't know exactly who, but you know, one of them was that many people think that ransomware is just overhyped. But it's kind of like life insurance, right? It's or saving for retirement. It's like, yeah, I know that's kind of an important thing, but I got a lot of priorities. I'll get to it next year. And then next year comes and you'll get to next year. And you're right. As long as it doesn't happen to you, it's no big deal. But when it does, I can't tell you. One of our first recoveries that we got involved with, the CEO hadn't slept for 10 days. He was a multi-billion-dollar company and he had been down for 10 days and it was millions of dollars a day of loss because they were operationally had 13 business functions and 12 of them were crippled. And so they were dead in the water. And what starts happening, it's not just, hey, I can't manufacture. My employees' productivity is thrown out the door because they can't do their work. I'm losing customers. So, and it's not just the customers today, but it's the brand damage do they trust doing business with a person who's unreliable, right? And those stories go on and on. And it's sometimes sophisticated companies, like that was a high-tech company in Asia, but one of our other ones or first ones was a construction engineering and construction company. And you'd think, well, what the heck? They're like $500 million engineering and construction doing construction plans and managing projects all around the world. And it's like, yeah, could you imagine what happens if you can't deliver proposals or architectural plans or et cetera. So yeah. And in that case, interestingly enough, they actually hit their domain controllers. It wasn't even a vital, you would think a data attack per se, as much as like hitting all their architectural plans and their engineering plans. It was literally, we're going to cripple you from getting access to those in a different way. And their domain controllers were down and they're of course all replicated and blah, 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 blah. So yeah, pretty frightening. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I've been on the phone with people just drenched in tears, you know, just want to know, you know, what the future holds. It's actually terrible. And, you know, we can have a long conversation about how that, you know, affects incident responders, but that's a whole other conversation. Yeah. I think it's worth touching on and just expanding on the point that you brought up is I just want to point out to everybody is that nothing in this conversation so far has been about traditional cybersecurity, right? We're talking about straight up crime, fraud, ransom, racketeering, you name any word. And it really speaks to the fact that cybersecurity, if you will, is, you know, all the controls we put in place and all this kind of stuff. But what we're seeing today in the 21st century now is really the fundamentals of crime and fraud that are manifesting in the cyber world. You know, they've been around with us for a long time. And so cyber is not necessarily its own domain. It is now something that's enabling these types of crime. And everything you were just talking about, Stephen, is you were mentioning business impact, people impact, you know, all these different components. So, I mean, is ransomware a cyber issue or is it a business issue? Is it what is it?
Oh, well, that's a loaded question. Well, look, cyber is a business issue. I mean, it's really risk management, right? It's your generally offsetting investments and control sets as part of your overall business risk business continuity and risk management posture. So mm-hmm. ransomware is just a new kind of disaster. If you think yep. about it, instead of a tornado, it's a gang overseas who's decided that they want to go after you financially, right? I mean, most of the time right now, it's all pretty much for financial gain. We haven't seen any more reckless or things, although what's going on probably in Ukraine is maybe a little mm-hmm. more, have a different means or mm-hmm. end in mind. But yeah, so it is a business issue. And in fact, we'll get into it maybe in a little bit, but I mean, it's one of the things that we're learning as we've brought our solution to market, which is that really the conversation needs to be about business continuity. What's the cost of a day of downtime? Mm-hmm. And if I could shave a day of downtime of your recovery, what's that mean to you? And or a day or a week or a month. I met with a large city in Midwest not too long ago, and they got ransomed and they chose to not pay the ransom. And along the way, they deleted their backups and their snapshots and corrupted things. And it was essentially a year-long recovery process in total.
Wow.
And they just looked at, I said, what brings you here? And they said, we'd never want to go through that again, ever, right? And it was literally their statement. It was pretty horrifying what they did, because during the whole way, their mission, which is civil service, right? We pay taxes so that we get services, everything from, you just think about it and say, oh, so your city gets done. So that, what they can't do? Well, think about 911 being down. I mean, hell, that happened in Atlanta for over 30 yep. days, a couple years back. Nobody talked about that too much. But it can be more basic. Imagine all the people who are building homes, the building department is shut down and you can't get your plans approved. And therefore all you're starting to burn cost on all your jobs. All your schedules get pushed back. You can't collect parking tickets for parking revenue, which funds the city, you know, typically in most cities. It's a trickle down that people don't really back to the business. It truly is a business continuity thing. But I think there's another part, if I could, when you say, is it a business or cyber? I think it transcends cyber, because if you really think of what's happening, somebody is taking down your systems. And when that happens, you really have two things you have to do. One is get them out of your house, right? Get rid of the threat, figure out how to contain it, remove it, and remediate it. I got to, right? At the same time, I got to restore my systems. So there's two trains that work almost in parallel. They cooperate, but they're really two different trains, right? So get them out of my house. Meanwhile, I got to get back to business. And so the reality is that the forensic side, the cyber, the threat removal, that's generally in the insurance world, they just call it the forensic side. That's really the cyber part of this. It's the IT shop, sysadmins who actually put the systems back together. And that's really more the reconstruction or the recovery train. Now, obviously, there's another train, which is a business management train that's overseeing all this and judging, hey, should we pay the ransom? How good are our backups? What's our recovery options? What's our insurance? What's our regulatory requirements? Let's put gag orders on everybody with lawyers to make sure nobody can talk about this. Because if we can keep it secret, we want to, yada, 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 right? So I do think when you think of it in those terms, the recovery invariably involves an IT function, which is not really cyber, nor is it, you know, the business. So there's really those three things in my mind.
So I wonder, I think it's time that we start digging in a little bit, but yeah. I want to sort of highlight something just for clarity is one, you know, you're not paying to be on this podcast, right? I mean, none of that stuff. This isn't like you call me and say, hey, I want to get on your podcast. It's actually me reaching out to you. I think it's interesting. So let's dig into it. So I want to go back and sort of set the foundation for everybody. So we talk about ransomware, encrypting your data. Nubeba is really kind of around the whole cryptographic element of this. And before we kind of, before I unleash you on this thing, is I think it's important to understand that the key is there's basically two types of encryption. You got symmetrical and asymmetrical. One you encrypt and decrypt the same key, and one you encrypt with one key and decrypt with the pair or opposite or the other key in the key pair. And it's interesting to note, if you really go back many years, back when you know they were making the wheel and I first got into security, like right with you, Steve, is you know, there were times when encryption was used for solely destruction purposes, right? So you'd find a way into a computer, wipe out its key, and it would just make it impossible to use. So think about how you might have your laptop encrypted, your hard drive encrypted. You know, that's not necessarily new technology. You'd wipe out the key and boom, your data was unaccessible because you don't have the key to decrypt it. With the, in my opinion, with the advent of cryptocurrency and the ability to monetize this type of crime, it was only a matter of time before the malware became, you know, really sophisticated to do a lot of things. We have, you know, ransomware as a service. There's a huge, giant economy around this and all kind of supporting things. So here, what we're going to get into is a product suite that allows you to almost basically get ahead of it. And so it's, you're able to interface. I'm not going to get too far into it because I want to give it to Steve, but you're able to get involved in this sort of the execution of the malware. So with that being said, it really kind of comes down to how you're dealing with malware beginning to start encrypting your data in preparation to hold you ransom for it. So over to you, Steve. Let's get into the actual product.
Okay. Yeah. Let me see if I can pick up on a couple of that framing points. So let's start here with the headline. So we claim to be able to do something that most people think is impossible. We can decrypt modern ransomware, and in order to recover people faster. It's a data recovery solution that's purpose built for ransomware attacks. Okay, so a lot in that. So I'll say it again. We claim to be able to decrypt modern ransomware, actually very important, without paying the ransom. Okay. so let's cover something that you touched on, something that's really important. So to understand what we have and what we do, and what it is and what it isn't, you can poke at it all you want. And we'll get into that. It's okay. So you started on it. So modern ransomware, what they do is the primary mechanism. And again, we're not talking about lockerware, which is whole disk encryption key messing around with. We're not talking about the double extortion. This is, I've encrypted all your files. You wake up one day and all your files are just gibberish. Okay. Whether it be a database, structured or unstructured data. Fine. Okay, here's what they do. They get in your computer, and they do lots of things to get in, move laterally. We know that. But on the moment of impact, in the MITRE matrix, the impact point procedure, they encrypt. Fundamentally, they use symmetric encryption. Symmetric encryption has a couple attributes. First, just define it. It uses the same key to encrypt as decrypt. Symmetric. It goes both ways. It's the same encryption that's actually used for the bulk encryption of TLS or SSL traffic, right? It's extremely fast and low power or energy consumption, meaning low CPU. Low CPU, low memory, extremely fast. Why? Well, they do that so that they can zip through and fly through files as fast as possible in case they get caught or detected. So symmetric encryption. So what do? They start to generate keys for each, typically one for each file. There's some variations here to all. There is no one size fits all, but they generate a key for each file and then they lock it up. They run it through symmetric encryption. And again, it's so fast and so efficient, it doesn't necessarily peak your computer. All right. Now they have all these symmetric keys laying around and it's like, well, what do you do with those? Well, then they do a second phase and they lock those up with asymmetric encryption. So you have small amount of data that then they apply an asymmetric effort to. Asymmetric is different. It's one key, a public key that is used to lock it, and then a private key that is used to unlock it, decrypt. Okay, so they do symmetric, then they do an asymmetric to lock up the key. So let me give an analogy. Guys, you're in your kitchen, you're fixing a sandwich, some guy gets in your house, he goes into every room, and on every door, he actually creates a combination lock and puts it on every doorknob. And then he takes all of those and puts them in a safe and spins the knob and says, okay, you need to pay me for the master combo that will actually then, to get the master combo back, then you could get your individual files back and your individual door locks open, if that makes sense. All right. So that's what they're doing. And when you're paying the crypto, you're actually buying from them a decryptor, which has that private key, that master private key from the asymmetric process embedded in it. And it has the logic that knows how to go look at every file and apply the private key to pull out the individual file key and then unlock each file as they go. So that's their business model. And as we said, that's the technical part of their business model. There's other elements. So obviously a ransom note and negotiations and things like that. So so that with me so far, is that
absolutely perfect?
Okay. Anything you want to add to that, or is that pretty?
No, well, I'm literally just engaged with you because it's interesting to understand. And I think about it technically about how they're organizing this activity. And it also, you know, kind of lends itself to how they can do different levels and unpack different things for you, creating multi levels of decryption, multi levels of ransom. And you unfortunately, you learn all this through the negotiation process,
right?
Because
right.
They start negotiating different parts of your data with you. And because they have a different key for essentially every piece of data, they have a map of all that. So they know right. exactly what file is encrypted with what key, and then they pack it away. And I think it's really important to recognize that you're not buying your data. You're literally buying the key to the lock to get to unlock it, right?
And
so that's
what
it really comes down to.
Right? They have customer support, right? Which is if the decryptor doesn't work. Now, there's a bunch of problems. Is that there's quality issues. Some ransomware is very good. And their quality of the decryptor as well as the quality of the support. Now, unfortunately, there's also people that say, hey, sorry, you couldn't get all your data back. Too bad. I got the money, et cetera. You're running it wrong. We just helped somebody with that. They were being told you're running it wrong. And the answer is no, your encryptor code in your malware sucked and you actually corrupted the data because it didn't have proper file locking and somebody was writing to it while you were encrypting it and you actually corrupted the file. There's data out there that depends on who you look at. Anywhere from, I think the data goes like this, something like 82% of people who pay the ransom don't get all their data back.
Wow, I didn't know it was that high.
Yeah.
That's
now,
amazing.
It could be some little bits, could be big bits, right? There's sure. another data point out there that says surveys, again, you don't know, that's coming from vendors. We all bend the truth for our favor. But the end of the day is that that also says something like, yeah, the average, you only get 65% of your data back because it's either corrupted or they get to a point and you're like too much burden. They're like, yeah, too bad, pound sand, and you're on your own. So you're paying all this money and people don't even understand that. I know you know this world, but we should probably cover that real quick. So you're ransomed now, your data's locked up, your transaction server doesn't work, your BMBKs are all gone, right? So entire computer functions are offline. And you're sitting there saying, okay, do I have backups? Well, it's very important to know that one of the steps that they normally do is that they will escalate privileges and turn off snapshotting and backups.
100%.
And they're actually even getting bitter. They'll actually spoof that it's still on and disable the function that it's not functioning, but they'll actually send out alerts or they'll hide and stop all the alerts, right? Because you'd say, well, I'll just make sure that my snapshotting's turned on or BSS is there. It's like, no. They actually have spoofing code that says BSS is on, but it's actually off.
And I want to point out something really quick is I find that problem very, very common. It's been around since the early days of Zeus, for example, and people really trust technical instrumentation. And because of that implied trust, they make certain decisions. So first of all, a lot of companies don't back up and certainly don't test their backups as much as they should. And the ones that are doing both of those are trusting the instrumentation. And of course, bad guys have known that for decades. And so they mess with your instrumentation to make you believe it. So anyway, yeah. I just think it's a great insight. These are little, by the way, for those listening, these are tiny little jewels that you may not hear from every other type.
Well, look, Palo Alto just put out a report that said 58% of the time people pay the ransom. So think through what that means. 58% of the time people pay the ransom means 58% of the time their backups were either attacked or insufficient. 58% of the time. Why? Oh my God, there's a million different reasons, but that's not the least of which is they're doing very good at attacking it. Secondly, though, is that most of the time backups were built for a different business requirement. Machine failure, natural disaster, right? The old 3-2-1 backup plan, or maybe how about data retention? Not for rapid recovery of an intentional attack. Right. So it's a really different business criteria. So this is not to say people are dumb. They didn't do good backups. It's you built and architected and designed and implemented your backups around a different set of requirements. There's a new requirement out here. and doing real-time snapshotting of everything all the time, of every piece of infrastructure and data, is not economically viable, not logistically viable. And even then, they can turn it off. So you need something else. And so you're forced, which is, do I have good backups? How long is that going to take? By the way, the average recovery from backups is 24 days. Nobody really thinks that through.
Transactions, if you haven't been journaling.
Yeah. So what's your, you start talking about RTOs and RPOs. What's your recovery mm-hmm. time objective, and what's your recovery point objective, and how much data loss do you have? Not to mention, if you're doing true system restores from full or incremental backups, whatever it might be, you're restoring the threat into your environment too. So let's not forget that. So your other option is, they try to make it, we're the easy button, guys. Just pay us a ransom. You'll get a decryptor. You'll get your data back. So let's transition. Decryption is actually a phenomenal way to get your data back, right? Literally, it's an RTO of zero. You're literally restoring data to the instant before it was encrypted, right? So there's technically no data loss, provided it was executed well. There's no movement of data around. It's all in place. You can go actually at machine speed. You're running, the IO is bound from memory to disk writes, right? And compute. And because it's symmetric, it's very efficient to decrypt, just like encrypt. I think Lockbit, BlackBerry did a test, and the fastest ransomware that they clocked was Lockbit going at 400 gigabytes per second of throughput. Wow. So technically, you can decrypt at 400 gigabytes per second of throughput too. That's far faster than trying to move tapes over and trying to transfer those across networks, right? Or what have you,
or even
basic IO on a machine. So it's pretty, so enter us. And we kind of need to get there. We've been at this for a bit. So when we were looking at this problem, we came at it a little bit more about our company. Prior to this, we had building network decryption technologies for next generation networking traffic, right? I don't want to go too far off on the side of it, but all network traffic is now SSL, or also called TLS, right? And there's the latest version, TLS 1.3, has provisions in it or advances in it that actually makes it impossible to do passive monitoring of traffic. And with cloud speeds, doing inline man-in-the-middle inspection to crack open traffic not only has privacy issues, but it also has performance and latency issues and things. And there's a growth of a thing called PIN certificates that doesn't even allow you to do that. So it's an interesting side note. We're worried about exfiltration of data, but more and more people aren't looking at all the data as it moves around on their networks deeply. So how the heck do you know what's really going on? If you think you're going to catch it through anomalous traffic, think again, because they're hiding in normal traffic patterns. So long story short, we had built a technology in the TLS world, in the network traffic world, that we've been licensing to security companies to build into their products. And what it fundamentally did is it said, hey, well, network inspection is really easy if you have the key. Where can I get the key? Well, the key exists on one of the two endpoints in a conversation. So we built a technology that now has we estimate over 1 million endpoints deployed that just sit on an endpoint. And when a handshake for a network connection goes off, it actually intercepts the key that is derived during the handshake and securely transports it to a decryption engine. So with the key, I can decrypt traffic at commodity rates. Okay.
So what's interesting is, there's a, I know we want to get on, right? But I knew this was going to happen. I have so many questions.
Yeah.
So, I go back many, many moons when I was really into IPsec. And so I started getting these questions about Ike and Diffie-Hellman and all these types of protocols that are used for that key exchange and the development of the key and that stuff. I don't want to get into it here, but so what you're saying is, to be able to get that visibility at the endpoints, you have some sort of capability, like a better term, an agent, I guess would be a fair word.
Yep.
And on the endpoint, so then that agent is sitting at some capability and within that system to be able to do analysis somewhere up the protocol stack. So as these negotiations are happening, you're able to be part of that conversation, is basically what it boils down to.
Yeah, pretty much. And so, I didn't want to get too sidetracked, but I just, that is a little bit of a credibility thing, right? So we've been building this technology, and that technology, we're kind of like BASF. We don't make the security analytics products that you have, but we're probably in them. And that business is actually growing, interestingly, because the pain is finally coming about. So roll forward. A customer comes to us and says, this is amazing, one of our licensees, and says, can you do SMB traffic? Could you do that? So we have an agent that gets the keys, gets the symmetric keys so that we can unlock and inspect any network traffic. Great. Then they say, could you do it for, not for TLS, but can you do it for SMB? We're like, for those of you who don't know, SMB is the protocol for network Microsoft-based file shares, file sharing. We're like, well, we do some research. Yeah, probably. Why? And they're like, because, you know, we're a network security company and ransomware is running wild through SMB. And with SMB, the latest version, it's all encrypted and there's no known decryption for it. And we're now blind. Okay, great. So you have stronger encryption, but now you can't inspect what's going on. So bad, good, bad, good, right? And so we come back and we say, yeah, we probably can, but why wouldn't you just solve that with snapshots? Like, oh, don't you know? They regularly turn off snapshotting. Okay, great. So 2 weeks later, my CTO comes out of his lab from a weekend and he says, look what I can do. And he developed a little agent and detonated ransomware. And we got the keys that they used to lock up the files.
That's so cool. That's so cool. That's like super cool.
Yeah, so that's fundamentally it. We commercialized that 9 months later, at the beginning of the first quarter of this year. And so we have a software system that if you deploy it before, what it does is it detects when they go to ransom your files. And as they're in the act of encrypting your files, we intercept copies of the crypto material that they use to do it. And with the keys in your hand, you don't have to pay for the keys, statement of obvious. All you need is a decryptor from us, a simpler decryptor, one that just does symmetric decryption, not asymmetric. Now, there's some nuances there, but that is fundamentally it, is that if you have the keys, you don't need to buy them. And there's a lot more to this. I'm being a little bit cagey because one of the bad guys could be listening if you're out there. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah. But yeah, it is a very, so imagine that, a very purpose-built system. It is a very small, it is an agent technology. Think of it as a microservice. And it detects anomalous file encryption. So we'll just put it that way.
So what you're doing is, and just for clarification point, is it encryption specific or does it have the ability to kind of look across like any type of algorithm? Are you algorithm specific or is it
generic,
more fluid?
Generic. Yeah, it turns generic. Out the beauty of this is that, look, it's really kind of interesting that in the last 20 years or so, there's been about 10 ways to encrypt.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And in fact, standards are created that go and are tested through time to be effective and efficient, non-crackable encryptions. And then we create standards around them, right? Or vice versa. We create a standard, we test it, validate it, the code improves so it has no vulnerabilities. And here you are, then you have a Salsa 20, right? Or Cha-Cha or something like that. And you say, great. And people produce libraries for it, et cetera, and referential code for it. The bad guys use that stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
They want good encryption. So they use good encryption, which is standardized encryption. But if you really get down to it, encryption is about taking a block of data with a cryptographically generated key, plus a what's called a nonce or an IV. So a random number plus a cryptographically generated number plus a block of data outputs another piece of data through some process. All we need is that little cryptographic key and you can reverse the process because it's a symmetric process. If they go off the rails, if they do asymmetric, they'll generate too much energy. They'll use up too much CPU. They'll get trapped by the EDRs. If they try to fuzz their code, which they are, and we have firsthand knowledge of that quite a bit, it's extensive, where they're trying to say, maybe if I change the crypto code and mess with it a little bit so it doesn't look the same, well, if they do that, then you actually could run the risk of making the encryption not work. And then actually your encryption can be hacked.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of boxed in. They have a very narrow runway. Yeah, they have to do, mm-hmm. if they want cryptographic to to be sound and effective, they have to stay on a very narrow runway. And if they get off the tracks, then actually they have exposures in their business models. And it turns out we have another service that we do on the side, which is if we find out that they went off every once in a while, we are actually able to actually hack and crack encryption after the fact, even if our software wasn't there.
So that's amazing. So let me ask you, all right, so now maybe this is a tough question, maybe not, I don't know. So how do you juxtapose your solution against things like nomoreransom.org, which has like, keys. I mean, there's like these quote unquote free access. We have Kaspersky, who's like publishing, I guess, ransomware decryptors and things of that nature.
Yeah.
Which says libraries tend to be growing. What's your take on that in comparative standpoint?
So remember, first of all, nomoreransom is a .org. If you haven't, people out there, if you're ransom, go there. Right. I mean, it's free decryptors and a community set of people, security companies and law enforcement, et cetera. And they're pooling decryptors, okay, for public use. So when in the beginning, when I said we decrypt modern ransomware, what you'll find is that nomoreransom actually is typically for either a couple scenarios. Old ransomware that's been cracked or hacked or busted. Like you get a hold of a version of ransomware and they find that there is a code problem in it, and then somebody figures out how to break it. And then they put their code up there, Kaspersky or whomever, and they say, hey, here's an answer. If you get hit by this, there you go. Well, the only issue is that the gang that actually did that, they know that they did that and they changed their code. And so the latest versions aren't up there. That's scenario one. Scenario two is, let's say the FBI cracks a crime ring or what have you, and they get the private key out of the servers, right? That they literally bust the ring and they actually get their software and they get the code and they get all their private keys and they'll expose those. But again, software is changing. I mean, every week they're putting out new versions. Every month we're seeing different variations pop up. It's telling us that there's SDKs being produced by somebody, that individual gangs that are quote unquote, maybe offshoots or franchisees or who you know, that's exactly what it is. There's a whole industry there. The code's changing. And so majority of the time it's not there. It's actually one of our biggest problems, right? So we come out, we say we can do the impossible, and then people go and Google and say, oh, so does everybody else. It's like, yeah, but the devil's in the detail. That's if that's true, then why are 58% of people paying the ransom?
Right? Exactly. You beat me to the punch on that one.
Well, there's another thing which I found, which you find kind of interesting. And I think you might even know a little bit about this because your history in the industry related to ransomware is that I didn't know this when we started marketing this, right? We were network security people and all of a sudden we're deep in this world of ransomware. It turns out that there are a couple people a few years back running scams. And you'd call them up and say, they'd say, hey, I can decrypt your ransomware. And I won't mention who, but they actually had a backdoor into the gang itself. So they were actually just paying you. You're paying the ransom through the good guys posing to be good guys, but they were actually on the take. And then there's some other folks who just literally just do it as a bait and switch. They say, call me up. And they're really just trying to become your incident response company. They'll go to noransom.com, and they're using those public available decryptors, which 9 times out of 10 are not useful for the modern attacks. Now that's
so frustrating because it's so bottom feeder. There's so many bottom feeders and ambulance chasers in this particular space. It's mind blowing. And, you know, if you get hit by ransomware, it literally is just, the whole world seems to surround you. You just have everybody wanting to help you, saying they can solve your problem. But this gets us into why this is one of the very few scenarios where you're actually almost, I use the term inoculation very carefully, but this is a true proactive thing that you can do.
Yeah.
This is a true proactive thing because its very nature as a security control is getting involved in key generation, full stop, right? Now, we don't have time. We need to have another podcast, but we can talk about all the areas of where encryption these processes and how you differentiate it in the system, things of that nature technically, but fundamentally, this is one of the few things. So let's talk, just take a few minutes, let's talk about the agent itself, right?
Yeah.
So is it, give me a feeling of footprint, deployability, platform support. Yeah. Just let's go through like the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, the spec sheet.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Yeah,
we haven't had this conversation.
No, that's why. Yeah, we haven't. So let's start here. It's for Windows and Windows Server only right now. And that's because 99% of all ransomware is executed. This is important. It's executed on a Windows operating system. Okay. It doesn't mean that they're not encrypting a Linux volume or what have you, or hypervisor based files, right? But it's being executed in Windows. Why? Because that's where all the vulnerabilities are and it's easy to get in and exploit, et cetera. All right, fine. So, which by the way means the receptionist desktop in the front of in your office actually could ransom the transaction server,
the entire
accounting
company.
Server, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
They click on the dancing penguin, and next thing you know, Bob in accounting can't access the CFO can't get the files, right?
It's amazing. Most people don't understand that. Yeah, most people don't understand it. They think I clicked this and malware spread around and then it ransom. No, I mean, you could click it. It could create a keying encryption server and then just start knocking your wall down.
Yeah, so. I should probably cover that very quickly. So imagine this. Ransomware just gets onto a laptop and it actually escalates privileges to the highest level IT person that's ever touched that machine, which is typically has God level privileges. And then they escalate into that machine. And let's say they want to execute from that. They start to mount servers across the network. Let's say it's SharePoint. And then they'll actually encrypt the SharePoint data in the operating system layer. So even though you might have SANs behind it, et cetera, they're going to be backing up and replicating encrypted data. So, So you have a whole ripple effect, and it's insidious of how easy it is to get in. All right, but roll forward. So we have this little agent. It's a system service. You deploy it. We have a bunch of countermeasures, so it'll sound very simplistic. So if you're anybody out there is interested in private showings, we talk to you all about the details here. But think of a less than 28 meg of memory footprint, less than a decimal point of a CPU core is its standing footprint. And by the way, that's the same footprint whether it's capturing keys or not, which means that people can't actually iterate against us and see when we're working or not.
Okay.
Which is a very interesting subtlety. It is a single single binary with a single parameter that's loaded to it. It can be pushed out through any way you want. GPO, Ansible, Puppet, Chef, whatever you want. Baked into golden images, whatever you want to do. We maintain global update servers to them. It has the number one reason why endpoint software fails is it's not updated. So we don't make it an option, but it does a transparent updates. So it's a very sophisticated piece of software. So you deploy it once, you forget about it. It's like a fire extinguisher. Maybe once a month. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
That's a good analogy, actually.
Yeah, well, that's because what I realized when we started to build the system is I went out with zeal, like every marketer, and saying, look at what my smart people invented. You guys need to look at this. And I started digging into it and realized, well, we're a disaster recovery solution, right? I mean, it's kind of like backup world, right? It's pretty much useless except for the day you need it.
This is the point that I think, and you and I covered this before, is and we started talking earlier about, is this a security or a business problem, or is it really all about encryption? Is it all about BCDR? Because one could argue is that by the time you're working with keys that malware is creating, the security problem is done and dusted, right? That horse is bolted. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You've been attacked. Malware's in there. It's got you by the short hairs and it's making it happen. And you're saying, okay, well, I have technology where this is a preventative measure in the event your security controls fail. This is your fire extinguisher. You know, your main alarm's going off. Maybe you hear it down the road. Maybe you don't. Maybe the water sprinklers came on. Maybe they don't. At the end of the day, you're able to kind of, I like the fire extinguisher analogy. So I think, and I know I've asked you something like this before, and I got to ask you again. I hear about something like this and I go, well, we put all kinds of certificates in our browsers that we don't have any control over, right? You know, Microsoft, Google, and all these guys, Apple do it, you know. Why are we not seeing this technology integrated in, say, browser technology? I mean, I know it has to be an agent on the system, so maybe it's, I mean, call a duck a duck. Why hasn't Microsoft picked you guys up? I mean, it just seems like it just seems like a no-brainer. If you're able to do this and you can stop this just ridiculous crime wave that just, I see no end in it, honestly. I really don't. And having, you know, when I worked at a company, when I was COO, where we were dealing with this stuff, this was our job, negotiating ransoms, paying ransoms, forensics, investigations. Right. You saw everything. And I was like, man, this has got to stop. And you see where the money's going, right? I mean, you know, it's not going to like buy Christmas presents, right? Yeah. And so the sad reality of it is it's going to very, you know, bad things. Just why is it, you know, it really seems cool to me. What am I missing? Why isn't this being bought by the truckloads? Why isn't Microsoft buying it? Why is it being embedded into Internet Explorer and Chrome?
Yeah, well, okay, well, so we could have a whole philosophical conversation there. So any Microsoft people listening, I apologize for what I'm about to say. But look, that's like asking the fox to watch a hen house. We have compensating controls because of that. And it probably begs to enter. I'm going to come back to answering your question directly in a second, but let's start here. When I first took this, my first answer was that, why don't I just take this to all the EDR companies and say, guys, bake this in. And I will tell you, we had conversations at the top with most of them. You know what I came to the conclusion of is this is an admission of failure. Their mission is to stop ransomware from happening in the first place versus deal with it after. And again, this is a BCDR data recovery solution. That is not the mission of cybersecurity. So I'm not a cybersecurity. So this is important because we started calling on CISOs initially. And what we found in a lot of calls, they were like, oh, this is really cool. And then they got more focused on, well, how could it be defeated? And what are all the problems with it? I'm like, okay, we're missing the point. So the real conversation is actually with the CIO talking about if security fails over there, do you have sufficient data resiliency to be able to recover given we know they're going after your backups? Does it make sense to have another compensating control? Right. And or mitigating control set. And that then is a very different kind of conversation. And so back to your question. Well, we talked to a lot of those folks. We got some interest, but I think we got a big pass, which is no, this is admitting defeat. Right. Think about this. I'm running an EDR company. I'm whipping my people every day saying, make sure this never happens. Sorry, I'm pounding on my desk. For people heard that. Make sure this never happens. You shouldn't have to do this. You needing this is because you failed in your mission. So nobody wants to buy a product that's countervailing to your overall mission. So, I mean, some do, but so I think we are just going to start having some conversations on the system side of the house, right? The system people who are producing system agents or system tools or even the backup world itself. The problem is that if you think about it, what's the storage industry's answer to ransomware? You just need more storage.
100%. Why not? Just get more.
And what's the answer to backups? You just need more backups. It's like, is it possible that you might need something new? Right? You have a completely new threat. Is it possible you might need something? So it takes a special kind of company to think and leadership to think outside and say, hey, strategically, I want to do something. Now, we are in those conversations, not with Microsoft, but we've had conversations. I think the other thing that I could tell you is that we did have some conversation with insurance. Now, we haven't even touched on cyber insurance in this whole picture, but they were one of the largest insurers. When we first came out, I had an audience with them and they were blown away. Their first answer was, how can we help? Because they're looking at it and saying, we're hemorrhaging and you could materially lower claim costs. Let's just call it what it is.
Call it what it is. Yeah. Yep. And the differentiator, I mean, there's so much advantage to the insurance company. And we're, and as an industry, we're at a very interesting tipping point with cyber insurance because it is now a real problem. And because the claims are so big, you know, they could literally price themselves out of the market altogether, right? We're making cyber insurance is unobtainable, which a lot of companies are required now to have either by law or by policy and as a backup. And now it's becoming more and more difficult to do that for all these reasons. So you're right. There needs to be a change. Yeah. I'm totally not surprised the insurance company is coming at you.
Like I said, there's a whole discussion about, you know, you need cyber insurance. It's hard to get, harder and harder to get. It covers less and less. And does that, are your damages from downtime purely financial? I mean, within the tall policy period, different discussion. Here's the net, though. They came back and said, yeah, we could see this being strategic. We could see this offering this, literally giving this to all of our customers. You need to go and get a year or two's worth of actuarial data before we do that. So this is brand new technology, brand new thing. So that's what we're out doing. And that's our challenge now is we call on people and we're learning who to talk to, like we were calling on the security side. Now we're exploring now calling on the sysadmin side, systems architects, the data center, right, the IT side of the house, per se. And that seems to be going very well. And I think that just builds early trajectory. You know, people wonder, you know, the next big thing doesn't happen overnight. It does take a snowball rolling and running to get big and get its momentum. I think that's where we're at now.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, you've been in this industry for a super long time. We've all seen interesting things kind of come and go. They had a bit of a niche, but very rarely does something come along that really kind of begins to provide you a whole nother domain of options in the threat, in the face of a threat that is completely prolific. It's everywhere. It's coming at you from every direction. It is the number one thing that most companies will come interface with from a cyber perspective or a business impact perspective. And it's surprising everybody. And I got to tell you, it would be nice to have that option. You know, yeah, it'll help you sleep at night.
Well, and I think the one thing that we didn't touch on is that I'll just plug this in there too, kind of continuing with the fire extinguisher thing. So this stuff is real, right? We all day long will detonate ransomware into people's faces and show it working, right? And that's usually the aha moment. People are like, oh, then it's just now it's a business discussion, which is, do you perceive risk and how much money you're willing to offset that risk? And you know, when we brought the technology out, I thought, oh, it's an agent. You just charge like an agent. And it's a, for me, it's a single agent, single purpose agent. So it's a fraction of the cost of an EDR or general endpoint software. And even then I got pushback from people. I was like, really? Okay. So then I started to innovate. And one of the things that you and I talked about early on is that one of the cool things that we do is that we right now we're experimenting and offering an alternative pricing model where you pay a smaller nominal fee to put the software in and we write a not to exceed price to decrypt. So let's say it's, it's $100 for how many, it doesn't matter, but $100. And you say, Jim, that, or Steve, that's too expensive. And I say, okay, I'll make you a deal. Why don't you charge you $50? I'll charge you $50 and then you pay me another $100 if I save you. It's like, do you want to, do risk return? So that's like, okay. So progress that. So I actually have three plans. I actually have a low deductible plan and a high deductible plan and a flat fee plan. So if you want no variability of potential costs, you just put the agents in, you move on. Annual fee. It's a fraction, like I said, of EDR. But the flip side is, out of today's budget, there's almost no excuse. You could put this in for pennies, practically, fund it out of budget dust, and then you defer the cost and say, and then we'll write a not to exceed, hey, it will not be more than this amount to decrypt you or a percent, fractional percentage of the ransom itself. So no matter what, you win, and you'll pay for that out of emergency funds or insurance.
It's amazing. Budget
and you defer the cost,
by the way.
Right? Yeah. So think of a pay-per-use fire extinguisher.
Yep, exactly. And you beat me to the punch. And I think, and what I find interesting is this is not quite to the level that you took it, but the concept of like retainer and instant response, that, you know, very big deal. And so that's a mechanism that the industry has come to understand. So budgets can be designed to facilitate that. And, you know, it's kind of like when you need it, it's there, but you don't have to pay for something that you may never need. So you've got this really interesting balance of, like you said, you know, a regular access to a fire extinguisher, but you don't have to necessarily buy the fire extinguisher. But if you use it, you got to pay to refill it, basically, yeah. Right? You use the what was in the container, lack of a better term. I think that's an amazing pricing model. I'm glad you brought that up because that was one of the questions I had for you and I failed to remember. But I think So you got a low barrier to access to the technology. It has a low demand on the system, but it gives you a whole other set of options that you don't necessarily have today. What I'm hearing. I know.
It's like insurance. Simple. You said it. It's BCD. It's Business Continuity Disaster Recovery Solution. So is insurance, right? And what do? You pay a nominal fee, and then you pay the larger amounts when the event happens. Okay. So it seems to me to be a much more natural business conversation or discussion. The challenge is right, we're selling to a technical audience and always technical audiences don't always grasp that. But it's not an indictment or anything. It's just not the thinking. But yeah, that's it, right? But we offer it each way. So have your plan. Look, if you have Windows Defender, you might want to go with a flat fee plan because they're coming for you.
Right? Yeah. Everybody's moving.
Yeah. If you've got some advanced stuff in place and a pretty sophisticated multi-layer and mature security program itself, then you could probably go with the deferred cost model. And we hope we never have to rescue. Now, we've had this out for about 9 months, and we've had a good number of rescues. It's one of my last problems here as a business challenge is, look, when the first thing you do is you call your insurance carrier, and then the second you call your lawyer, or maybe your lawyer, then your insurance carrier. And what they all do is they put NDAs on everything and nobody talks about anything. So I have zero ability to quote references. And I decided to actually adopt that. A part of our thing is we want to be stealthy. So I've adopted now a company policy is that we do not talk about customers' names, and we don't even ask for customer named references. We put out press releases regularly saying, hey, we just rescued another person. We just did one last week, which actually involved some corruption recovery, too.
Lovely.
And I think that was Black Cat. So one of many challenges back to the why doesn't Microsoft or somebody else, I think we have the luxury right now, which is we're under most of the ransomware radar screen right now. We have plenty of countermeasures planned, but and some implemented, and but we're not on their radar yet. So, and we'd like to keep it that way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I just want to take a moment before we close. I have one last question for you for the listeners, but I want to go back to something I said at the very beginning is I remember the very, very early days of encryption where it became more readily accessible. I mean, if you go back to Zimmerman and PGP and all this kind of stuff, okay? And like I said at the beginning is even in the old days, like crazy old days, we were using it to destroy data, right? I mean, sometimes we encrypted data for the specific purposes of like, well, we didn't call it then back then, but we were like digitally shredding it, you know? Mm-hmm. And there were times when we had giant hard drive shredders. You know, you had to cram a hard drive through a shredder to get rid of data. And we said, we're just going to encrypt it and wipe out the key kind of thing. We'll do different things to mess with data. Now you can destroy data for all different purposes, whether it be for security or for, nefarious purposes, you pick it. But we use encryption to do that in some cases, right? So that was 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago. So the whole point I'm even bringing this up is encryption is a knife that cuts both ways. It can help you in many cases. It can create a degree of privacy and create a degree of authenticity. It helps us with identity and access controls. That's a giant one where it's used, of course. So when we talk about encryption, we talk about the use of cryptology, cryptographic measures in a computing system. These are fundamental. Absolutely fundamental on so many levels. And you don't touch anything these days without encryption being involved some way, call it blockchain or, cryptocurrency all the way through email. Something's happening, shopping, credit cards, it's touching your everyday lives. So it's not like this is going to go away, right?
Right.
It's not like
right.
the concept of using encryption against your business. And so imagine that's becoming more and more part of how computers operate. I'm showing my hand moving up into the right. And then now it's conflicting and intersecting with more and more digitization of businesses that are typically have not relied on digitization, a lot relied on information systems. So as information and digitization becomes more and more important, everybody's now becoming more and more potential victim. And the simplicity, let's be honest, the simplicity and the combined with sophistication and aggressiveness of these crime syndicates, lack of a better term, it makes you a target. And if you're not a target today, you're going to be a target tomorrow. So we have a scenario where encryption is a big part of how things are happening, good and bad, mostly bad at the moment. Cryptocurrency certainly is not going anywhere, maybe until quantum computing fires up. But the point being is, I guess what I'll get down to is this is very interesting to me. I think it should be interesting to everybody. Now, Steve, you mentioned earlier, people like sometimes it's kind of start to cut it up and say, well, how can I fail? And here's all this holes and all this kind of stuff. I would just simply say to you is anything is going to have holes in it, right? Everything's going to have a potential Achilles heel. But if you just don't line up all your Achilles heels to one arrow, you're going to be in good shape. So anyway, listen, I just, something tells me this is really, really cool. I think we should do another one where we maybe talk to somebody technically and start answering some really technical questions. But those aren't the ones that concern me. I'm not concerned about that. I think we have enough technical solutions out there that they're questioning. This is, seems like one that, you know, all it's got to do is work some of the time and it's going to do better than 90% of what's out there. But I think it's working a lot of the time because you and I have had some really cool conversations. Yep. So let's just end it on this is, where do people go? How do they go and get in touch with people from your team to take a look at this? Yeah.
See, I'm a poor marketer. I should have led with that. So it's maybe everybody listen to an hour of me to just get to the punchline. No, www.nubeva.com. We have a fair amount that describes what we talked about here up there, some videos that show some demonstrations of this working on live ransomware. And if you're serious and are interested in this, we'd love to do a private briefing for you, and see if it fits your business. I mean, we're driven every day to try to help people recover from that worst day of their life. And like you said, I don't think we have a silver bullet, but we have a very important new technology in the fight. And I think the one thing that we've learned over the years in cybersecurity and in IT is you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You have multi-layered control sets. You have a multi-layered security strategy. You have a multi-layered backup strategy. Ransomware is a new kind of disaster, and you need another layer for that. We think we're a new important layer that people should seriously consider. And especially if you consider some of those economic things, it's sort of a you know, we scratch our head and say, have we removed every possible objection, right? Well, I even put in place performance guarantees. Nobody does that in IT, right? If I can't recover you, you shouldn't have to pay for the fire extinguisher, right? So then it just comes down to, why wouldn't you? That's kind of what I've challenged my team, my company to do, is to get to a point where we just have such an airtight technical and business case that you stop and say, why wouldn't we just add another control set? There's just, so that's what nubeva.com. If you're interested, we'd love to talk to you. If you have ideas, we'd love to hear from you. You know, we're all in this together, and you're right. Ransomware is not going anywhere. It's a $50 billion industry. It's got multi-layered distribution and operations happening. It's not going anywhere because it's being successful as an industry. Little more.
It absolutely is. Yeah. Yeah. Steve, first of all, it's always a blast talking to you. I have such a great time. It's been great catching up with you. I can't begin to thank you enough for coming on the show. I know we went a little long, but it's worth it. I think this is super cool. And again, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And to everybody listening, thank you very much for joining, and see you next time on Security Bites.